I want you to picture a scenario. You've just dropped a serious amount of cash on a high-end computer setup.
Okay.
I mean, we're talking the work's fastest processor, a graphics card that costs more than my first car, terabytes of storage, the whole nine yards. It's on your desk, gleaming. You plug it in, hit the power button, fans whir, lights come on, and then nothing.
Just a blank screen.
Just a black screen. No logo, no cursor, no nothing. You have all this incredible power, but you can't actually do anything with it.
That is a tragedy. What you have there is essentially the world's most expensive doorstop.
Or a very fancy paperweight with lights.
Right.
And the reason it's useless is what we're digging into today. We're sort of crossing a divide in our series. We spent a lot of time on the hardware, the physical stuff, the 220, 1101 exam material. But today, we're shifting over to the software side, specifically the 220, 1102 material. We are unpacking the operating
A
system.
ghost in the machine.
Exactly. And our mission today is to figure out how this, invisible layer actually works. We're looking at sources covering architecture and functions of modern operating systems, and we're going to go from the shiny icons we click on all the way down to the gritty details of kernels and bits.
Because most of us just take the OS for granted until it crashes.
Which is how it should be, right?
It is. The best operating system is the one you don't even notice. But when you peel back the layers, it's not just software. It is system software. It's the great coordinator.
The great coordinator. It sounds a little dramatic, but in practical terms, what is it actually coordinating?
Think of it less like a wedding planner and more like an air traffic controller mixed with a universal translator.
Okay.
Its main job is to provide a consistent environment. Without an OS, every single program, your browser, your games, your spreadsheets, would have to know exactly how to talk to every single chip on your motherboard.
So wait, if I didn't have Windows, the person who made my video game would need to write specific code just for my brand of hard drive.
Exactly. And your brand of keyboard, and your monitor, and your mouse. It would be impossible. The OS just steps in and says, "Look, I'll handle the hardware. You just talk to me."
There's a formula in the reading that caught my eye. It puts the OS in a math equation. It says OS equals storage plus processor plus devices plus input output plus memory.
I love that equation because it highlights the burden on the OS. It's not just a list of parts, it's a list of liabilities. These are all finite resources.
Right, you only have so much memory.
You only have so much processor time. The OS is the sum of these parts because it's the manager of their scarcity. It has to decide who gets what and when.
So it's constantly rationing things.
Constantly, it's managing contention. If two programs want to use the printer at the exact same moment, the OS is the referee that says, "Nope, you wait, you go first."
Speaking of printers, let's talk about the translator part. I think we've all had that moment. You plug in an old printer, and the computer just sort of stares at it.
It sees it, but it doesn't know what to do with it. That's
Yeah.
almost always a failure of the driver.
The driver. We download them, we update them, we curse at them. But what are they fundamentally?
Fundamentally, they're a phrase book.
A phrase book.
Yeah. Your OS speaks a very standard high-level language, but your specific printer from 10 years ago speaks a very weird, specific dialect of electronic pulses.
Okay.
The driver is just a little piece of software that translates the OS's standard command, "print this," into the specific signals that make that specific printer work.
So when I can't find a driver, it's a language barrier.
Completely. The OS knows something is plugged in, but it has no vocabulary to give it instructions.
Okay, so that handles the hardware. Sitting on top of all this, we have the applications, the stuff we actually care about using.
Right. And this is where the genius of the OS really shines. Applications rely on the OS for all the heavy lifting.
Give me an example of that, because when I'm in, say, Microsoft Word, it feels like Word is doing everything.
It feels that way, but think about the save function. When you click save, Word doesn't know how to spin the platter on your hard drive.
It doesn't need to know the physics of it.
No. It just turns to the OS and says, "Hey, here's a file. Please put it in the documents folder." The OS handles all the physics.
That must save a huge amount of programming overhead.
The massive amount. If every app developer had to write their own code for hard drives and network cards, software would be huge, buggy, and incredibly expensive. Instead, that code is written once inside the OS, and everyone just borrows it. It's like a public utility.
So we know what it does, but the OS isn't one single thing. I mean, the landscape out there is a zoo. Windows, Linux, Android.
It's a very diverse ecosystem, but you can really group them by what they're trying to achieve.
Let's run through those groups. The most obvious one is what we're using right now, the single user multitasking system.
Your general purpose workhorses. Laptops, desktops, one person at the keyboard, but the OS is juggling a browser, music, email all at once.
But then you have mobile operating systems, and I feel like people just think of those as like small windows.
That's a huge mistake. They're architecturally different because their constraints are different. A mobile OS iOS, Android, is obsessed with power management.
Because there's no fan.
There's no fan, and there's no plug in the wall most of the time. If your phone's OS acted like a desktop OS, the battery would die in 20 minutes and it would probably burn a hole in your pocket.
The source also mentioned they operate in a cloud-based environment.
Right, they offload a lot of the work. They assume you have connectivity.
Yeah.
A lot of the heavy thinking for mobile apps actually happens on a server somewhere else, just to save that precious battery life.
That transitions us nicely to servers.
The heavy lifters.
Yeah.
Network servers are often specialized. You might have an OS that does nothing but serve websites.
A web server?
Right. Or manage a database. They're often headless, meaning they don't even have a monitor plugged in. They just focus on pure throughput and stability.
Okay, those are the computers we see. But what about the ones we don't? Embedded systems.
This is where the numbers just get huge. Embedded systems are in everything. Your washing machine, your thermostat, your car's fuel injection system.
How is an embedded OS different from Windows?
Purpose. Windows is designed to do anything. An embedded OS is designed to do one thing very, very well. It doesn't need a web browser. It just needs to make sure the spin cycle starts on time.
But there's a subcategory here that the sources highlight, and it sounds intense. Real-time operating systems or RTOS?
This is a critical distinction. An embedded system might be your microwave. If you press popcorn and it takes a half second to start, nobody cares.
Right.
A real-time system is for when that delay is completely unacceptable. Think about the anti-lock braking system in your car.
Oh, wow.
Or a pacemaker. If the sensor says the wheels are locking up, the OS can't say, hold on, I'm loading something.
Yeah.
It has to react immediately. We're talking microseconds.
Yeah.
In an RTOS, it's not about raw speed. It's about determinism. You know exactly how long a task will take every single time.
That definitely raises the stakes. So within all these types, there's this huge philosophical divide. Open source versus closed source.
This is the biggest religious war in computing. And it all comes down to the source code, the recipe.
So closed source, that's your Windows and your Mac OS.
Right. Also called proprietary. The source code is a trade secret. It's a black box. You get the finished product, but you can't look under the hood. You have to trust the vendor.
And open source, like Linux.
The recipe is public. Anyone can look at the code, change it, fix it, break it. It relies on the idea of many eyes to find security flaws.
Now, I've heard people say Linux is safer because of that, and others say it's riskier because hackers can see the code too.
It's a double-edged sword, for sure. But here's a nuance from the source material. Architecturally, they're not as different as you might think. Both Windows and Linux are described as hybrid systems.
Hybrid of what?
It's about the kernel structure, the core of the OS. Historically, you had monolithic kernels, where everything was one big, fast, but dangerous pile. If one driver crashed, the whole OS came down.
High risk, high speed.
Exactly. Then you had microkernels, which were safer, but way slower. Modern Windows and Linux are hybrids. They try to get the speed of monolithic design, but with the stability of modules. So even though they're legally opposites, their blueprints have actually converged over time.
That leads us to how we interact with them. The interface.
The shell.
The shell. Is that just another word for the screen?
Not exactly. Mm-mm. The shell is a program that runs on top of the OS kernel to accept your commands.
Yeah.
Kind of wraps the kernel, which is where it gets the name.
So in Windows, that's Explorer, the thing with the start menu.
That's the one.
Right.
And mostly we use a UI, a graphical user interface, icons, a mouse pointer. Before that, it was just a blinking cursor.
The GUI really democratized computing, but let's talk about versions. Because while we're all on Windows 10 or 11, the source makes a great point about legacy systems.
It does. And in the professional world, newer isn't always better.
Why not? If I'm running a hospital, don't I want the latest, most secure OS?
You do, but you also want your multi-million dollar MRI machine to actually work.
Does Windows 11 break MRI machines?
It might. Imagine that scanner was bought in 2010. The control software, the drivers, everything was written for Windows XP. If you just update that computer to Windows 11, those drivers break. The whole scanner stops working.
So you're stuck.
You're completely stuck. And it's not just technical, it's regulatory. Medical devices get certified as a complete package. Change the OS, you might void the certification. That's why you can walk into a modern building and see a screen running Windows 7. It's not laziness. It's a hostage situation.
That is terrifying and fascinating. Okay, I want to shift to something that affects how a computer actually feels to use. Multitasking.
Ah, yes. The history of frustration right here.
We used to have something called cooperative multitasking, and cooperative sounds so nice.
It sounds lovely, but in practice, it was a disaster. In the old days, like Windows 3.1, the OS was weak. You would hand the processor to an app and just hope the app would eventually give it back.
The honor system.
Precisely. And the problem is, bad code isn't honorable. If a program crashed, it would never signal, I'm done. It would just hog the CPU forever.
And because the OS gave up control.
The whole system hung. You'd move your mouse and get those weird ghost trails across the screen. You had to pull the plug. One bad app could kill the whole machine.
So how did we solve this? Because my computer almost never freezes like that anymore.
We switched to preemptive multitasking. We stopped trusting the apps.
So the OS became a dictator.
A benevolent dictator, yes.
Oh.
It sets a timer. It gives an app a tiny slice of time, milliseconds. When that time is up, the OS physically interrupts the app and says, time's up next.
So if the app crashes now,
the OS just cuts it off. The app itself might freeze, but the OS takes back the steering wheel. That's why today, if your browser crashes, you can still move your mouse, open Task Manager, and kill the browser. The OS never surrendered total control.
That is a massive evolution.
It's the only reason modern computing works, really.
Okay, we've covered a lot, but we have to tackle the elephant in the room, the jargon that confuses everyone. x86 versus x64, 32-bit versus 64-bit.
Oh, the alphabet soup. This trips up so many people.
Let's start with x86. When I see x86, I just think old.
And you're mostly right, but the name is confusing. x86 refers to the family of architecture used by Intel processors, because the old chips ended in 86, the 286, the 386, and so on.
Okay.
The thing is, for a long time, that family was strictly 32-bit. So in the industry, x86 just became shorthand for 32-bit.
And x64.
That's the 64-bit extension of that architecture. And a fun fact, it was actually invented by AMD, which is why you'll sometimes see it called AMD 64, even on an Intel chip.
But history aside, what's the actual practical difference for me?
Memory. That is the hard wall.
Explain that.
Think of RAM as a huge set of mailboxes. To use a mailbox, you need an address for it. A 32-bit system only has enough address numbers to label 4 gigabytes of RAM.
That's it, 4 gigs.
That is the absolute ceiling. It physically cannot count any higher than that.
So if I buy a laptop with 16 gigs of RAM, but I install a 32-bit version of Windows on it,
you've just wasted your money. The OS will see the first 4 gigabytes, and the other 12 are completely invisible. It's like buying a mansion, but losing the keys to every room except the foyer.
That is a painful image.
It is. Now, there were some old hacks, like PAE, that tried to work around it, but they were clunky. For the exam and for real life, 32-bit means you hit a wall at 4 GB.
And 64-bit.
The ceiling is, for our purposes, effectively infinite. It's measured in exabytes. We're not going to hit that wall in our lifetime.
What about compatibility? Can my 64-bit OS run my old 32-bit programs?
Generally, yes. It has a compatibility mode built right in, but it doesn't work the other way. You cannot run a 64-bit program on a 32-bit OS. The peg is just too big for the hole.
And before we wrap, what about the processors in our pockets? My phone doesn't have an Intel chip.
No, it doesn't. Mobile uses a completely different architecture called ARM, Advanced RISC Machine. We don't need to get too deep in the weeds, but basically, Intel and AMD use complex instructions. They're muscle cars. ARMM uses a reduced instruction set. It's much more efficient.
Which means better battery life.
Exactly. That's why ARM completely dominates mobile. And now, we're seeing it cross over into the desktop world with things like Apple's M-series chips. The lines are really blurring.
So we've traveled from the user interface, the shell, and the icons, down through the different types of OSs, looked at preemptive multitasking, and hit the bedrock of bits and RAM.
It's a pretty incredible journey. All of this complexity, the drivers, the kernel, the memory addressing, it's all happening constantly just so you can watch a cat video on YouTube.
And whether you're prepping for the A+ exam or just trying to figure out why your laptop is slow, these concepts really do matter.
Right. Preemptive multitasking explains why your whole computer doesn't crash anymore when one app glitches. x64 explains why you can actually use all that RAM you bought.
It turns the magic into mechanics.
Exactly. And once you understand the mechanics, you can troubleshoot. You can upgrade. You stop being afraid of the black box.
So here's a final thought for you to chew on. We talked about the OS being the great coordinator, maybe even a dictator, It controls the hardware, it controls the memory, it controls everything we see on the screen.
The invisible hand.
Yeah. We barely notice it when it works, but if the OS controls the entire environment we exist in digitally, how much does our choice of OS dictate our digital freedom? If you're running a closed source OS, you're living in a rented house where the landlord has the only key to the maintenance room.
You have to trust them to fix the pipes.
Whereas with open source, you own all the tools.
But you also have to know how to fix your own pipes.
It's a trade-off, isn't it? Convenience versus control, and which one you value more. Well, that's a big question.
That is a very big question.
Something to think about next time you boot up. Thanks for diving in with us.
See you next time.